Brett Inbody, and I'm the chief judge, and I'm suffering from allergies or this temperature going up and down or something, and my voice sounds a little rough, and I apologize for that, but there's not a thing I can do about it. I'm pleased to be joined this morning by Judge Pirtle on my right and Judge Reedman on my left, and this is the morning session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. When I call your case, please come forward and be seated at the council table. Then I will call your case a second time. If the appellant wants to proceed immediately to the podium, that's fine, but I'm still going to call your case a second time. And the reason for that is that helps with the finding cases on the recording process that we're using to keep track of all these different cases. We also are live streaming across the NET, and so anything that you say is going to go online and it's going to be out there. There's no button pushing preventing people from hearing anything you say, so just be careful what you do say and make sure that you want that to be known publicly. The first case this morning is In Re Interest of Jordana H. et al. The first case this morning is In Re Interest of Jordana H. Good morning, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. Also have something for us.
Take your time. We won't start the clock until you're ready to go.
I'm ready. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jeremy Jorgensen. I'm arguing on behalf of the appellant. This is a juvenile proceeding, which was a very complicated case. At the heart of the case was a very novel theory brought by the state called psychosocial dwarfism. As best we could gather during the course of the litigation, psychosocial dwarfism is a condition. It's a medical condition. It's diagnosable, but it's a condition that very few doctors know about. In this particular juvenile case, the adjudication and the disposition were combined. The problem that resulted from the adjudication and the disposition being combined in this case is that there were issues that would fall under Daubert, Schaeferman, which are very, very difficult, if not impossible, to dissect.
How does Daubert apply when the rules of evidence don't apply?
Well, at the adjudication phase, the rules of evidence would apply. At the dispositional phase, the rules of evidence are relaxed.
Did the appellant ask for a Daubert hearing?
No, there was no Daubert hearing requested specifically.
So how can there be error when the lower court wasn't given a chance to rule on it?
Well, the lower court was given a chance to rule on it. Multiple times. Every time that a doctor, for example, Dr. Bueller, who was probably most closely able to talk about psychosocial dwarfism, every time he got to the point in the discussion where he made the diagnosis, or when he went to talk about how it's diagnosed, or the factors that are involved in making the diagnosis, foundational objections were made to his ability to testify in that capacity.
Didn't two other doctors also testify
yes,
to that same diagnosis?
They did, and I could go through what Dr. Haney said in relation to psychosocial dwarfism, but I'll admit to this court that Dr. Bueller was probably most closely able to talk about the issue, but I don't think he ever got to the point where he should be qualified as an expert.
What evidence was there that he wasn't qualified as an expert?
Well, on cross-examination, it was very clear that he had never done any independent research. He had no rate of error that he knew as far as diagnosing psychosocial dwarfism, no particular methodology. There was no study of his mode to diagnose psychosocial dwarfism as compared to another. Also, I think just simply his ability to diagnose it in general. He's not an expert in psychosocial dwarfism. He was a geneticist. And during
doesn't that go to weight and credibility, which is a question for the trier of fact?
Well, I think that's still a foundational problem with his ability to testify as an expert. He did testify that he had, and just to be clear, Skyler, Taylor, and Jordana, there were no allegations of abuse. It was the association with Ashton. So when we're talking about abuse and we're talking about the condition of psychosocial dwarfism, that is simply related to Ashton. Dr. Buehler testified on cross-examination that there are a certain number of genetic conditions that are known, identifiable, and therefore diagnosable. There are, and I don't have the exact numbers, but tenfold as many possible genetic conditions that are known, but that are not diagnosable because it's only theoretical. There are this many genes in the human body, this many chromosomes, and as a result, our best guess is that there would be this many genetic conditions, but we can only diagnose this many. Now, it was also readily admitted that he had never diagnosed psychosocial dwarfism before, or maybe he had. Maybe he had seen it in Vietnam. And he also testified that there were a number of things that could cause psychosocial dwarfism. It could be abuse. It could be lack of nurturing by the mother. It could be just like it was in every other case that he'd ever seen, which was in Vietnam. Psychosocial dwarfism caused by the environment, caused by a war, caused by bombs going off. Children who were properly cared for by their parents, but who just grew up in an environment that was psychologically tormenting to a degree that their growth hormone shut off and they didn't grow. It was also admitted by Dr. Buehler that there are possible underlying genetic factors.
Didn't he kind of, through a type of differential diagnosis approach, rule out the genetic possibilities and the mere fact that Ashton grew and flourished so much in a short period of time after being removed from his home that Buehler was able to say, I think this is dwarfism?
And that's correct. That's the only way that psychosocial dwarfism can be diagnosed, which is why the foundational objections were always made, because none of the experts brought by the state or the guardian ad litem were experts in psychosocial dwarfism. It was almost a de facto diagnosis. Well, current modern Western medicine doesn't have any other diagnosis since we took him out of the home and he's growing. This is the only one in the diagnosis code book that we can diagnose him with. It's either diagnose him with this condition that we find in the absence of another known condition or not. Well, the problem is if you don't have an expert who has studied it, who's done independent research on it, and which we did have at the criminal trial, however, that's not on the record, but just for the court's information, at the criminal trial, we did bring that.
I don't think we want to know about what happened outside the record.
Well, to highlight the point that none of these folks were experts in psychosocial dwarfism, none of them had ever published anything on psychosocial dwarfism, none of them had read the most current literature on psychosocial dwarfism, no independent studies, no known rates of error, all of the things that Kaczynski talks about in the Daubert opinion. We have to know the biological chain of events, and we have to have someone who can testify to what happens between point A and point C.
So I'd appreciate if you'd refresh my memory on the record that we have before us. A follow-up to Judge Pirtle's question. During the adjudication hearing, you indicated that when there was testimony about this condition, that there was an objection for lack of foundation. Was there a specific request at that time for a Daubert hearing?
It wasn't a specific request for a Daubert hearing. It was an objection asking the court to not allow expert testimony because the expert wasn't qualified to talk about the topic, which is what Daubert talks about. It's just the gatekeeping duty of the court to keep junk science out. So the objections that were made were exactly the same objections without the citation to the case.
So as I understand it, your complaint is not in regard to the testimony that came in during the disposition, but it goes back to the adjudication itself. Is that correct?
That's incorrect, unless I misunderstand.
Well, I think we both agree that you can't. I mean, the rules of evidence aren't followed as far as the disposition is concerned, are they?
Maybe my misunderstanding is that here the adjudication and the disposition happen simultaneously. And as a matter of fact, when the court made its ruling, essentially the analogy that I would draw is that the judge says, I've already decided I'm going to sentence these folks to termination. Therefore, the guilt phase is irrelevant. And that's what the order says. I have decided under 292 that I'm going to terminate. Therefore, I don't need to make findings under 3A. That's one of our arguments about why it's very confusing, especially in a complicated case like this where we're talking about science and whether or not it's valid science, that we should not have a combined adjudication and disposition.
Which leads us to your contention that there should have been two separate here.
Absolutely. It's impossible to decipher from the record what objections were allowed just for purposes of termination as opposed to for the adjudication when they happen simultaneously, and maybe they didn't even happen simultaneously. It seems what the court here did, and if you look at the court's final order, it says, I'm going to terminate, therefore I don't even need to get to the 3A stuff, which is jurisdictionally necessary before the court gets to jurisdiction. In essence, the court sentenced these folks on a relaxed standard of evidence prior to adjudicating.
Even if we were to take out the diagnosis, isn't there enough in the record to determine that these parents' rights were properly terminated? When you take Skyler's testimony, my brother sleeps in a dog kennel, he can't eat at the table with us, the school's testimony about him trying to hoard food, isn't that enough to support the trial court's decision?
My time has expired. Do you
mind if I
address
that question?
Just momentarily. I think the most powerful evidence that was introduced is what appeared to be a shoe print on the face. And that was troubling through the whole trial. However, the broken bones from Kansas, objections were made as to the foundation. Clearly, we didn't have an expert radiologist who was willing to testify that those were broken bones. They didn't show up on the current bone scans. There were foundational problems. The issue here is that there seemed to be very clear underlying genetic conditions that Ashton has that were unknown and undiagnosable. And when the state was allowed over our objections to talk about psychosocial dwarfism, it muddied the waters so severely that we couldn't tell what was accidental trauma versus what was inflicted trauma, and whether or not there ever was inflicted trauma. It's very clear from the record that there were underlying genetic predispositions, if not a genetic disorder. We didn't get an expert. We asked for one, so thank you.
Thank you.
Excuse me, counsel. I know we've taken you over, but that does raise another issue that I was concerned about. You're not court-appointed, are you?
No.
Are you aware of any case where the court has appointed an expert or a parent or even in a criminal case for a defendant where they have their own counsel as opposed to court appointed?
Absolutely. I just did a two-week murder trial. I was hired privately, and the court appointed for Derek Strickland and Terrell Newman in Omaha. It was Judge Stratman. Appointed Dr. Cena, who is the chief medical examiner in Chicago, and it was based on a motion and an evidentiary hearing where there's a good body of case law that suggests that the standards for a person who is at some point declared indigent, whether they have private retained counsel hired by themselves or from a collateral source, it should not impede their ability to have an expert to confront the wall of experts that the state puts on.
Was there an affidavit filed in this case to establish that your client was indigent?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. How long did we take counsel over?
2 minutes.
Would you please add that to the appellee's side? Good morning, counsel.
Good morning. On behalf of the juveniles, Jordana, Taylor, Skyler, and Ashton, I am Audrey Elliott. I'm the court-appointed guardian ad litem for all four of those children. Your Honors, this case started off pretty wishy-washy. There was concern that Ashton was mistreated poorly in his house. Teachers called into the hotline. There were several hours taken trying to locate this child. Upon finding him, they found multiple scrapes, bruises, what appeared to be a shoe print on his face, what appeared to be a shoe print on his shoulder. And in between that time, the HHS worker and the police officer noted that several changes were being made in the household every time they came back looking for him. There were inconsistencies given as to where the child might be, who he was with, where they were going, what they were doing at that time. By the time they located him, again, he had all the scrapes and bruises. They took him to the emergency room. They took several pictures, several of which you have had the chance to review. This little boy who was just about to turn 6, his birthday's November 1st, they were removed on October 12th. 6 years old, and he was smaller than a 2.5-year-old child. Through the course of that, then, there were several hearings about what we needed to do with this. The state filed a 3A with the 3 older children. In December of 2011, there was a 4th baby born. That child was removed immediately upon her birth. The state then moved straight to TPR. Now, one of the complaints by Appellant Carlos, who was represented by Mr. McDonald in this appeal, not Mr. Jorgensen, stated that there wasn't sufficient process, but there was. Juvenile cases are civil in nature, and under Chapter 25 about perfecting service, once something is filed, either it's physically handed to you, or you can waive that service by showing up, addressing the court, asking for specific release from court, and that's exactly what happened. The parents asked for visitation with Jordana. That was one request. The mother got some of that. The legal father at that time did not, which was Appellant Carlos. So they waived service on that, so there was service on all 4 of the juveniles. Related to that, there's a complaint that you can't file a TPR motion unless you file a petition under 3A or some of those other categories. But that, too, is incorrect. There's cases out there, specifically one, In re Joshua, that says, and that's from about 2003, I believe, that says the specifics of some of those subsections, 43-292, say certain provisions of those do not require a 3A petition nor a 3A finding. So you can proceed. You can file an original petition, obtain original jurisdiction on the TPR motion. So that the second argument, I believe, is completely moot in the face of the case law and the statutes.
In reading those cases, is there a need to find that the child would come under 3A in order to proceed with the termination?
No, there's not, Your Honor. What that In re Joshua M talks about, kind of at length, it says there's certain subsections of that, like 1, 5, and 6, that specifically basically show you can go right to it because of aggravated circumstances, things of that nature. Now, Chapter 43 in itself talks about having exclusive jurisdiction over juveniles, but the 43 subsection 247 doesn't say you have to have a 3A or 3B or sub 1, whatever, prior to a TPR. It's considered an original case. You can file it right out the get-go. And in fact, that happens to say a person has been abandoned and the mother or the father of the child wants to terminate the parental rights for adoption. They don't have to get a 3A to do that. They can file straight with 43-292.
I understand that, but I'm concerned about the aspect of, is it a disposition or is it an adjudication? Because it makes a difference as to what rules of evidence apply.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. Under the termination statute, the rules of evidence are much relaxed. They're not strict. Under an adjudication for such as a subsection 3A, that is going to require strict rules of evidence. But I must remind you, Your Honor, that both the appellants, Appellant Carlos and Appellant Jennifer, did not object to the cases being consolidated. In fact, it was raised several times. The lower court judge said, I want to make sure we're all clear this is what we're doing. So yes, there's a difference as to the finding of how we're going to proceed. But that doesn't mean that you have to have a 3A before you go straight to TPR. Because in a 3A, what we're going to do if we adjudicate is we're going to find a plan to maybe rehabilitate this family. Under a TPR, what we're going to do is sever those rights and have those children move off with somebody else who can provide necessary care and protection.
You're going to have a hearing to determine whether or not you should terminate the parental rights. It's not a given that they're going to.
You're absolutely correct.
To terminate that.
You're absolutely correct.
And so then that raises the issue again as to do the rules of evidence apply, because is it an adjudication to get to the termination, or is it a disposition without an adjudication?
Your Honor, how I would say that is, yes, the strict rule of evidence apply under an adjudication phase because we're going to figure out what we're going to do. If the person filing the TPR motion isn't successful, then they go right back to what they're doing. So that in and of itself would say what we're going to do with this case. Under a TPR motion, it's either we're severing the rights or we're not. Under a 3A, we're either going to find an adjudication and say services are needed or we're not.
I understand that, but my question comes down to the rules of evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, in the disposition, which is what the normal situation is on a termination case, because there's already been an adjudication, then the rules are relaxed.
On the TPR, yes, they are.
On the termination.
Yes.
But in this situation where it's a combination that you have to find that it's in the best interest of the child and that there's one of those categories that comes into play, is that requirement changed because there's not an adjudication beforehand?
And no,
then, you see. And so then is it just a disposition? And so the rules of evidence are not followed? Or is it a combination adjudication, termination? And if that's the case, when does the rule of evidence apply and when don't they apply?
Well, Your Honor, I can understand the concern by having both the cases consolidated. And I guess my use of the word disposition means what we're going to do after the fact. So, and I'm understanding your use of the word disposition means the disposition of a TPR is what I would call the adjudication, determining whether or not the rights are terminated. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's what my concern
okay.
is, because if you're saying it's an adjudication to determine whether or not their rights should be terminated, then the rules of evidence would apply.
Well, Your Honor, I guess in my opinion, it's a determination or an understanding of semantics of adjudication or disposition. The way the case law reads, termination actions can be filed exclusively on their own under the Chapter 43, and the rules of evidence are completely relaxed at that point. Under any other...
No. Is that case law or is that statute?
It's both, Your Honor. There's been case law that has interpreted the statute to say this is what it is. There's nothing specifically in the statute that says you do this or else. It's all the cases that have been filed to determine is the strict rule of evidence apply or do they not apply in a TPR proceeding.
I know they don't apply when there's been an adjudication, but are you saying that specifically, and I don't remember seeing that in your brief, maybe I missed that, I don't recall seeing something that says specifically when there is just a petition for termination, not an adjudication, just a petition for adjudication, that the rules of evidence do not apply.
Your Honor, I can't remember off the top of my head if I wrote that specifically in my brief or not, but like I said, let's say for instance you got a child that's been abandoned by a person and there's no juvenile court jurisdiction at all. That parent wants to terminate the parental rights to then go to an adoption. They go in for a TPR hearing. The rules of evidence are still relaxed even in that. So it doesn't matter whether it's through a juvenile code or
situation that you've just described, mm-hmm. has the parent whose rights are being terminated contested the hearing?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
They've contested.
And you have a case that says that that's the case in an abandonment situation?
You know, Your Honor, I don't have the case on top of my head, but I mean,
okay.
Chapter 43 and termination, they have been ruled on, and tons of case law are out there that talk about it.
I understand that, but I mean, I don't think it's as clear cut as you're indicating. I mean, I think that's what's my concern. I understand if there's been an adjudication and then a termination, I understand all that. But if it's just a termination, I think there's a contest as to whether or not the parent whose rights are to their children are being terminated, do they have a right to have some rules of evidence followed for their protection, or are they just entitled to due process? That's the issue.
Your Honor, I agree with that, and I guess based on my experience that in a private, I'll call them private TPR cases because the state wasn't involved, the rules of evidence were relaxed on the TPR. Now, I'm not going to say they're out the window. That's not what I'm suggesting at all. They're just more relaxed, which leads to one of the issues about the expert in the Daubert Schaferman's request about the appellant. There was never a request to do that, and again, because TPR rules are a little bit relaxed, you don't have to do that. However, there are some cases that say, hey, if we're going to get close to this, the court still has an obligation to do its, you know, gatekeeping duties to make sure that this person or those persons are qualified. So even if this court decides that Daubert should have been done, even though there was never a request made, and the notice of these experts were identified 5 to 6 months prior to this trial even happening, there was no depositions taken of these experts, even if this court says, you know what, I think we should have applied a little bit more stringent, The lower court did do its job of gatekeeping duties. The experts got up and said who they were, where they went to school, where they studied, practiced medicine, not studied law, excuse me, where they practiced, what areas they practiced in, what research they have done. Now, there is some concern that these doctors haven't diagnosed psychosocial dwarfism a lot, but it still is a medical condition that exists out there. And basically what it shows is that the child did not produce its own growth hormone because the environment in which they were placed was so severe and so neglectful that their body just shut down. But once the child is removed and you've ruled out any other genetic causes, which in this case Dr. Buehler did, he said that he's done test after test. They came back several times. He thought maybe it was this. Turns out it wasn't. He thought maybe it was that. Turns out it wasn't. He said nothing else can explain it. He, Dr. Haney, and Dr. Gural said that's the only way to make it. Now, the appellant says it's junk science, but I'm not one to sit up here and tell the medical community what they can and cannot do. But it is a diagnosable disease out there. It was diagnosed in this case. And I don't know what else tells you anything, but once that child was removed from their parents' home, he grew without any medical intervention. And that's the key there, is what the doctors are saying, is that typically, maybe they're lacking growth hormone because it's something genetic. It didn't happen in Ashton's case. He grew without any sort of medical intervention whatsoever. And once he did, he started to become a more buoyant kid. When they first walked in, the HHS worker said he walked with a very stiff gait, you know, and kept asking for food, when can I eat, I'm thirsty, that type of stuff. And by about a week later, when he went back to the hospital, none of those same requests were there. His skin had cleared up, he was happy, his body was a little bit looser, and it progressed that way. So psychosocial dwarfism was the basis of this, which then extends to the children, or the other children in the home. It doesn't, the statutes of the plain meaning basically say a child or one of their siblings have suffered chronic abuse while in the care of their parents or neglect or whatever else you're finding under 43292 shows that those children must be removed. And that's exactly what happened here. There was clear and convincing evidence that this child was not receiving the care he needed. But it wasn't just only him.
Please finish your thought.
Thank you. Skylar, too, as you listen to Gina Townsend's testimony, she said this child was different than her other ones. Her answers were clipped. She said, a lot. She thought about things. And as time finally went on, it was probably 7-8 months, she finally got some answers of what was going on. And her concern was that this child, Skylar, had become so used to lying for her parents, trying to protect her brother, that she, too, was traumatized. So it wasn't just only Ashton's medical condition. And that was the crux of most of what it was. But the other children had been harmed in that way, too, because they got to watch their brother be put in a dog kennel. They got to watch their other brother getting hit by shoes, thrown down the stairs, not get any food. You know, they had a glorious bedroom. They had beds. They had toys. They had all sorts of pink stuff, but there was nothing there for Ashton. So those two children were going to be just as traumatized. So I think there was sufficient evidence, even if you take out the ruling or diagnosis of psychosocial dwarfism, that the lower court had clear and convincing evidence. I would say surmountable amount of evidence to remove these children and to terminate their parental rights.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How long did I take for you? Counsel, I'll give you a minute 12 for rebuttal if you want.
Counsel, real quick, did you file an appearance of counsel in this matter before today?
No, I did not. I'm arguing on behalf of David McDonald, who had to go out of town. Just briefly, listening to the argument of the guardian ad litem, I want to follow up on the last question that I got from Judge Reidman about whether or not there was sufficient evidence even without psychosocial dwarfism as to the abuse. And the answer to that is no. My answer was there was a shoe print. And I think it's clear that the shoe print happened while Ashton was in the custody of the mother or the father. I think the testimony was clear that nobody else was watching Ashton. But there was a question about how the shoe print happened. And whether or not it was even a shoe print. Outside of that, and that was very troublesome, because clearly Ashton was injured. Was he injured because he fell down the stairs? Was it a shoe print? resulting from someone slapping him with a shoe, and then who hit him with the shoe. There was no clear and convincing evidence anywhere that Jennifer and Carlos ever intentionally abused Ashton.
What about Skylar's testimony?
Well, Skylar did testify that she hit Ashton. She also testified that the parents hit Ashton. So was it clear and convincing? And this is another problem where we didn't get to have an expert to talk about how many times these children had been forensically interviewed and how the stories evolved over time.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, have you entered your appearance this morning in the clerk's office?
Yes, I did. I signed in for Mr. McDonald. I crossed his name out. If you would like me to file
it. Yeah, you'll need to file something in appearance in the record. I've asked you to do that before you leave today.
I will. Thank you.
All right. Matters deemed submitted. Thank you very much for coming in. You're excused. The next matter is Burnett versus Tyson Fresh Meats, Inc.